Good morning. Welcome to the NADDOC Summer Lyceum. My name is Nancy Horowitz, and I'm the moderator for this morning's program. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding, world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is held at the historic Unitarian Universalist Church in downtown Peterborough at 11 o'clock on summer Sunday mornings. We invite our New Hampshire Public Radio audience to attend these programs and to meet our speakers at the receptions afterwards. After the talk, I will read questions from our live audience. Our speaker today is Margot Adler, a national public radio correspondent and author who is based in NPR's New York Bureau. She is heard regularly on All Things Considered, Morning Edition, and Weekend Edition, enjoying a very successful career as a journalist who also explores the common ground between culture and politics. She has covered such topics as the death penalty, affirmative action, Hurricane Sandy and its aftermath, as well as the controversy over the proposed Islamic Center near Ground Zero. She has also reported on gender fluidity, homeless LGBT teens in New York City, the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and recently on New York's Stop and Frisk policy. Some highlights of her fascinating career include her report on the confrontation between radicals and the Ku Klux Klan in Greensboro, North Carolina. In 1984, she reported and produced an acclaimed documentary on AIDS counselor in San Francisco. She's reported on homeless people living in the subways, on the state of the middle class, and on the last remaining hospital for treating leprosy, which was located in Louisiana and shut down only a few years ago. From 1972 to 1990, Adler created and hosted live talk shows. One of those shows, Hour of the Wolf, hosted by Jim Freund, continues as a science fiction show to this day. From 1999 to 2008, Adler was the host of NPR's Justice Talking, a weekly show exploring constitutional controversies in the nation's courts. Adler is also an author, as she published the first comprehensive study of nature religions, entitled Drawing Down the Moon, Witches, Druids, Goddess Worshippers, and Other Pagans in America, and a 1960s memoir, Heretic's Heart. She has just published an Amazon single, Out for Blood, which treats the topic that she will be speaking on today. A longer version of this study will be published as a book at the end of the year. Please join me in welcoming Margot Adler, who will speak on vampires, morality, and the fate of the planet.
Good morning. So what you're going to hear is really different from the Margot you know on NPR. I just want to warn you. And I've decided to be not vain and wear my reading glasses so that I can actually give you the quotes I want to give you. So here we go. So in 1966, Stuart Brand, who went on to publish the Whole Earth Catalog, he went on to found The Well, the Global Business Network, he took an LSD trip. Now, you may wonder what Brand's acid trip has to do with the question why vampires have such traction in our culture. But just hold on. So he was 28 years old, he was on a rooftop in San Francisco, he was looking out at the horizon, and he remembered something he'd heard in a lecture by the architect and futurist Buckminster Fuller, that people perceived the Earth as flat and infinite, and that was the root of all their misbehavior. So looking at the horizon from the rooftop and being stoned out of his head, he could suddenly see that the Earth was curved, and he could think it and feel it. And he suddenly thought, if there was a photograph of the Earth from space, no one would see the planet in the same way. Now, he printed up several hundred buttons and posters. He thought hard about the phrase to use, and it was, "Why haven't we seen a photograph of the whole Earth yet?" It was at the beginning of the Apollo program. He sent the buttons to NASA, to members of Congress, to UN and American diplomats, to Soviet scientists, to Marshall McLuhan and Buckminster Fuller. In fact, there were already a couple of photographs of the whole Earth from space, but they weren't good ones. They were fuzzy photographs from satellites in black and white, and it would take a good color photograph to have real impact. It would take another 2 years in Apollo 8 before a NASA photographer would give us that picture now called Earthrise, and it would take a few more years until the blue marble picture of the Earth was published. Perhaps it's the most reproduced photograph in the world. So hold that image of the Earth in the back of your mind, the Earth from space, as we go on a very strange journey. It begins with death. To be honest, I had never been interested in vampires. I had read Anne Rice's Interview with the Vampire. I had read perhaps The Vampire Lestat, and being a friend of Whitley Strieber, I had read The Hunger, and I'd seen that very sultry film with Catherine Deneuve and Susan Sarandon and David Bowie. But the subject of vampires didn't really interest me at all. In May of 2009, in a New York airport, right before I went to a festival, I wanted to pick up a trashy novel, so I picked up the first Twilight novel, and I read the second one on the plane ride home, and it probably would have ended right there. But 10 days after I returned from that conference, my world turned upside down. My husband and life partner of 35 years was diagnosed with terminal stomach cancer, and he was the healthiest man I knew. It's often said that Anne Rice began her huge saga, The Vampire Chronicles, because she was dealing with the death of her young daughter. And so I, too, started obsessing on vampire novels because I was thinking about mortality. My husband, who was dying of cancer, was someone who wanted to live forever. He had fought death every moment of his life. For John, death was the most important fact of life. Both his parents had been killed when two planes collided over Baltimore in the 1950s. He was 16, he was the oldest of four, one of them was only 4 years old, in an instant, his whole life changed. He thought about death constantly, and it forever negatively colored his life. He always wondered if death wasn't perhaps the most horrifying and painful event a human being could possibly experience. Perhaps his parents were caught for eternity in that last painful moment of the plane's explosion and fire. There's a famous Woody Allen line. You've probably heard it. I don't want to achieve immortality through my work. I want to achieve immortality through not dying. That's what John wanted, although probably, to be truthful, he wanted both types of immortality. He read everything he could on anti-aging research to help that possibility along. He was an experimental psychologist by training, and he was making his living as a science journalist who focused on evolution and quantum physics and computers. We had both read probably 1,000 science fiction novels before we met. We both believed that science fiction opened vistas, that it allowed so many different ways to imagine life and work and love. John looked at the stars with his 5 telescopes. We talked about all the wild things that might be possible, colonies in space, cryogenically preserving our bodies. A lot of the stuff was just way out there, but there was never a boring moment in 35 years. John definitely had what I would call the high-tech view of death. As I said, he read every article on anti-aging research. He took all these vitamins and supplements. He was fit. He was a runner. He was in perfect health. He never smoked. And unlike me, he never did any drugs in his youth. He thought he would live to be 100 or preferably even older, given scientific and medical advances. His attitude was definitely rage, rage, rage against the dying of the light. And then he got the kind of stomach cancer which usually attacks people in Asian countries who eat spicy foods. He had only 2 weeks of symptoms, and after 9 months of chemo and radiation, he died. There was a definite tension between John and me over views on death. Tension I didn't really understand until after he died. I, at the same moment he was fighting death, had more of an earth-centered pagan perspective. We're all part of the life cycle. Like a seed, we're born, we grow, we sprout, we mature, later we decay, making room for future generations who, like seedlings, are reborn through us. This is all part of nature's dance. To everything there is a season, like the old psalm says, and that should be enough. As for the persistence of consciousness, deep down I thought, how can we know? Perhaps we simply return to the elements. We become earth and air and fire and water. That seemed okay to me. So there was this continuing, unexpressed tension between my own pagan worldview that accepted death as natural and the high-tech futurist views of my late husband, who fought death with every breath. But neither of us was wedded to a single vision, and way down deep, there was a part of me that wanted to live forever. What I now realize is that these differences about the end of life that existed between my husband John and me are the very same tensions that exist in some of the most interesting vampire novels. The vampire of myth and literature embodies a complicated split. They have near immortality, yet they're tragically frozen in time. They can't grow and change like the seasons, or in most descriptions, birth new life. And yet they have increased strength and agility, heightened senses, and often the wisdom that comes with advanced age, a kind of jaundiced view. If you think about Rosalie, for example, who desperately wants a child and bemoans her frozen state in the Twilight novels, she's asking the same questions posed in books like Tuck Everlasting or Olaf Stapleton's incredible science fiction novel in 1930, which basically describes a far-flung future of humanity over 2 billion years and almost 20 different human species, several of them long-lived. This tension over death is part of who we are. Human beings want to be part of nature, but at the same time, we have a deep and passionate urge to persist, to live forever, to cheat death, to push the end of the envelope, to be more. Vampires let us play with death and mortality. They let us ponder what it would mean to live a truly long life. How would that change one's view of everything in society? Would we become bored? Would we become more or less compassionate? Would living a long life allow us to see the world differently, imagine social structures differently, have a longer view? Would it increase or decrease reverence for the planet? Is the vampire's frozen state sterile, as Rosalie opines in Twilight? Does life only mean something when it's part of a larger cycle of birth and growth and decay and death and the birth of new life? Is there a beauty that only comes from the cycles of which we are a part? Or is the heroic struggle imagined by every superhero a worthy one, a symbol of our striving to break through our human and planetary limitations? So my own journey started with this issue of mortality. But I realized very quickly that even the wish for immortality did not explain the millions of readers, the movie viewers and television watchers who were devouring vampire stories, or the billions of dollars that Hollywood and the television industry was spending every year to serve these stories up for a willing audience. I also realized that my own fascination, even my love of vampires, was more than a desire to live forever or for my husband to live. Truth be told, I wanted to be one, and I was not alone. Of course, everyone said to me, isn't the whole vampire obsession really about sex? And if you read some of the more popular vampire romances, you might come away with that idea. But as I began to read about the vampire fantasies of others, I realized that while romance and sensuality were abundant, sex, as most people think of it, as intercourse, was not very prevalent. There are dreadful vampire romances with repetitive and formulaic sex scenes and really bad writing and phrases like, he filled me, over and over until you want to barf. And the heroines in these books are gorgeous, flawless beings with thin waists and large bosoms, and the men are dark and mysterious. And always, always, there are perfect orgasms every time, aided by telepathic communication. We should be so lucky. But most of the vampire fantasies experienced by women and men are very different. In Martin Ricardo's fascinating book, Liquid Dreams of Vampires, he spent 6 years collecting the dreams and fantasies of men and women who found themselves obsessed by and attracted to vampires. Most of the men said they not only were attracted to vampires and the women, they wanted to be one, and they fantasized that they were vampires. Some of them wished for immortality. Many identified with the vampire as rebel and alien, lonely outsider. Some expressed a love of the vampire's strength, their lack of ties to the world, their lack of commitment, their sense of power and lack of limitations. Sex was definitely secondary. Kathleen Ramsland, the biographer of Anne Rice, writes in Piercing the Darkness, Undercover with Vampires in America Today, that when she was young, she was fascinated by Dracula. She wanted to feel what he felt when he went after his prey. I went to bed each night, she writes, with my arms crossed over my chest, this is when she was a kid, in the hope that I would waken as a vampire. I told people I was 403 years old. Without knowing how to articulate it, she writes, I sensed there was some visceral quality in the vampire's experience that would enhance life and make me feel as if I was part of something much larger. In many novels, vampires can't have normal sexual intercourse. If you think of the vampire novels of Anne Rice or of Chelsea Quinn Yarbrough written in the 70s and 80s, a time when explicit sex was common in literature, there's no intercourse. Unlike many of the current vampire romance novels, the novels by Rice and Yarbrough emphasize, like the fantasies of Ricardo, sharing of blood, feeling of total ecstatic union, which Ricardo says implies feelings of connection, intimacy, sensuality, arousal, without any direct connection to sexual intercourse. In other words, it's a sensual rather than a sexual experience. And you could argue that the vampire is clearly speaking up for a more female-centered form of love and sensuality, but it's not sex as we tend to think of it in popular culture. But I'm going to argue that just as rape is not about sex, but about power, so underneath much of the romance and sexuality that we see in vampire fiction and films is a deeper exploration of power and its abuses. And power is something we all tussle with, and it's something most of us want more of. If you had power over others, how would you use it? That, Amy Smith, an English professor at the University of the Pacific in California, says, is the central question in almost every good vampire novel and film. Smith teaches a course on vampires in film, and she's thought a lot about power. She's a Quaker. She also teaches a course on the literature of war. She says almost every good vampire film is about the use and abuse of power. Here's her argument. The central question in so many of these films and novels is, now that you're a vampire and have these extraordinary powers, do you say, we're at the top of the food chain, we can do what we want, humans or cattle? Or do you say, we were once human, how can we treat human beings as cattle? Smith says the struggle at the heart of almost every vampire movie is the old struggle, does might make right? And it's the same tension we have in our normal lives. Does having more money than others, or more power or status, give us the right to use it to dominate others? Most of us are in conflict over issues of power. We want it, we distrust it, we get twisted by it, we abuse it, we struggle over it, we love it, we hate it. And in a shifting, changing world, we often feel powerless. It's easy to see why teenagers who often feel vulnerable, powerless, and invisible in the world are attracted to vampires. They experience the abuse of power more clearly than grown-ups who have acclimated to cultural norms and keep telling them, that's how the world is, honey. Bullied by other children or becoming bullies themselves, under the thumb of parents in school, young people are in the best time of their lives to understand the abuses of power in society and to imagine another world where these issues are resolved differently. Anne Rice, the author of The Vampire Chronicles, and one of the first authors to really flesh out the morally conflicted vampire, which is the main thesis of my talk, has the best description I have ever read of why vampires have such power and traction for teens. Right now, she wrote to me in an email, the vampire reflects more than anything else the tremendous need of adolescents and young people to embrace their monstrous and outsider status in society, their refusal to see themselves as the criminal class they are often forced into being, where their established rites of passage are understood to be forbidden sex, illegal drugs, and sometimes criminal rebellion. The vampire, she concludes, the metaphor for the outsider in all of us, is romanticized by them because they so desperately need to find a noble path through the hideous passage that Western culture has set up for them. They so desperately need to find a noble path through the hideous passage that Western culture has set up for them. Meditate on that line for a moment. Let's face it, many teenagers feel high school is a time when they feel most powerless. High school is often a horror made worse by the pressure of cliques and consumer culture and issues of money and status and clothes and class and color and popularity and sports. not to mention the academic pressure placed on them by parents and school authorities. Sure, many sail through this seemingly unscathed, but for others, vampires are the perfect antidote to the pull and pressure of parental and corporate culture. Think about the Cullen family in Twilight for a moment, having to do high school over and over and over. Think about having to go to your senior prom 5 times in 5 different schools. Now, that's a real horror story. And it's all about navigating the hideous passage Western culture has set up for them. And part of navigating that passage is coming to terms with issues of money and status and class and the lure of celebrity and so many myths in our culture. The lust for power and status draws one in, like an addictive drug, promising false happiness, perhaps like the glamour from the eyes of a mythic vampire. This may give us a clue as to why the image of the vampire is so often used to depict robber barons and corporate raiders on Wall Street. Using the word vampire in this political way goes back to the 17th century. I reported on Occupy Wall Street during 2011 and 2012. I was a political activist in my youth. I was arrested in the free speech movement in Berkeley in 64. I worked for civil rights in Mississippi and black voter registration in 1965. When I began to report on Occupy Wall Street, I was fascinated by how creative the OWS protesters were during many of their demonstrations, more creative than what I remember of demonstrations in the 1960s. I also noted that in several parades and demonstrations, OWS demonstrators wore costumes depicting themselves as vampire bankers, complete with fangs, white makeup, black capes, an image of corporate America sucking the lifeblood out of society. Since the economic meltdown in 2008, journalists writing about Wall Street have often used phrases that compare transparency and regulation with the light of the sun that would kill a mythic vampire. Writers would describe Wall Street executives as fleeing before the shining light of public scrutiny. Here is Rachel Lewis of the group Public Citizen writing a blog in the Huffington Post in the fall of 2011. "It's dark enough outside as it is. The economy is weak. Most wallets are thin. When Sanders released what was just one day's worth of trading data, and it's 3 years old at that, like a single ray of sunlight, it's already enough to make the vampires scream. Time to summon the sun. They may have fangs, but we have the numbers. Who else is ready to take on the vampires of Wall Street?" There's a reference to vampires as political and economic bloodsuckers all the way back to 1688. In an essay by Charles Forman, Observations on the Revolution of 1688, finally published in 1741, Forman writes about the vampires of the public and the riflers of the kingdom. The French writer and philosopher Voltaire had a listing for vampires in his 1764 Philosophical Dictionary. After saying they were clearly not real, he adds, "We never heard a word of vampires in London, nor even at Paris. I confess that in both these cities, there were stock jobbers, bankers, and men of business who sucked the blood of the people in broad daylight. But they were not dead, though corrupted. These true suckers lived not in cemeteries, but in very agreeable palaces." Frederick Engels, who often collaborated with Karl Marx, talked about the vampire property holding classes in the condition of the working class in England, first published in 1845. Karl Marx continued the notion of capitalist bloodsuckers in his essay, The 18th of Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte, first published in 1852. Marx wrote that the bourgeois social order has become a vampire that sucks out its heart blood and its very brain and throws it into the alchemist's pot of capital. He also describes capitalism as vampire-like in his huge work, Capital. Vampires are also associated with power politics and political gamesmanship in today's modern vampire novels. Unlike other supernatural beings in fiction, like werewolves or witches or zombies, one of the reasons that vampires find political intrigue almost as thirst-quenching as blood is their long life. Let's face it, political strategy becomes vastly more interesting if you have hundreds of years to move your chess pieces. Here's one example. Jeff Gillenkirk's wonderful political novel, and this is a guy who was actually a speechwriter for Mario Cuomo. His novel is Pursuit of Darkness. He imagines an election somewhat similar to 2012. It involves a powerful GOP political operator, Jonathan Dees, who is clearly a Karl Rove figure. Dee's claims to be a 200-year-old vampire. Our protagonist, an alcoholic Washington Post reporter, has no way to prove this, but he comes to believe that there are vampires in the halls of power and in the FBI, and that they have their own long-term agenda, part of which is simply assuring that the world continues to have a plentiful blood supply. The same idea figures in the recent book and movie Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter. Here, most vampires are seen supporting slavery during the Civil War for very similar reasons. The Chicagoland vampire series by Chloe Neal, very fun, is filled with, you guessed it, Chicago politics. Chicago's mayor and other politicians are involved. And let's not forget E.L. James' ruthless CEO, Christian Grey, in the bestseller 50 Shades of Grey. That book started out, the hero was Edward Cullen, and it was vampire fan fiction. It was Twilight fan fiction. And then she changed it. So it's a reminder that vampires and the politics of Wall Street are closer than you might imagine. But vampires have not only been a symbol of abusive economic power, there are broader issues of power and identity here. And occasionally, in TV movies and shows, they even reimagine power. Take Buffy the Vampire Slayer, for example. Now, I confess I never watched Buffy originally. I scoffed at it. When I began to be obsessed with vampires, I watched all 7 seasons. But here is something that most people don't know. More than half the scholarly articles on vampires are all about Buffy. There's a magazine called Slayage that still publishes scholarly articles about Buffy more than 6 years after the show ceased production. Many feminist scholars have noted that Buffy the Vampire Slayer has a totally different notion of power, what feminists have always called power from within as opposed to power over. Buffy starts out as a simple high school student. For those of you who've never watched it, she's unexpectedly called to fight evil as the chosen one. But by the 7th and last season of the television show, everything is in question: her leadership, her authority, her morals, her power. And the women who join her to be vampire slayers reject her power when it's based on hierarchy. Buffy is forced to listen, to communicate, to change, as Elizabeth Rambeau says in an article in Slayage, from an I to a we, until Buffy comes to reject authoritarian power, even her own, and by the end of the show, she shares power with all potential vampire slayers and becomes a symbol of feminist, non-patriarchal leadership. It may not surprise some people that Buffy the Vampire Slayer looks at issues of power, but I would argue even Twilight is more about power and identity than sex or sexual abstinence. So who is Bella in Twilight? She's an only child of divorce, which I am too, so I was very taken. She's living in a town with not much going on. Her father's a cop. She's a middle class. The dad's a nice enough guy, but there's not much happening in the way of deep reflection. Bella's mom is living in Florida with a minor league ball player. There's not much going on there. So, you know, whether she lives in Florida or she goes back to Forks, Washington, life's pretty barren. School isn't very interesting. She's pretty much alone, again, the outsider. And the two families that come into her life and change her world, oh yeah, they bring excitement and attractive men, for sure, but also very different notions of power, identity, and class. Jacob's world is a large extended family filled with indigenous people and tribal lore, working class. It's a huge clan, one with long traditions, wise leaders, superhuman powers. Edward's family is also large and extended, although one based on those who've been rescued by Dr. Cullen. It's a family of choice. It's upper class, super educated, rich, worldly, many languages spoken. There's a European heritage. Classical music is played on the piano. Multiple degrees are on the wall. And of course, there are all those otherworldly powers and abilities and even near immortality. Both families are more interesting choices than her family of birth. And both families have a secret outsider life. As for Bella, she, like so many teens, feels like an alien who is more at home in an inhuman world than a human one. And as she negotiates the school lunchroom and the upcoming prom, she's a perfect case of someone who, in Anne Rice's world, is seeking a noble path through the hideous passage Western culture has set up for them. But here's the thing. All these things I've told you still didn't answer my question. Why do vampires have such traction in our culture now? I was still perplexed, and I thought all these issues, power and identity, the outsider as persecuted rebel, the fear of mortality, the desire to defeat death, none of these things gave me quite the answer I was looking for, and none of them really explained why vampires are so popular right now. So one day, I just simply took all the most popular vampires on television and wrote their names on a list on a piece of paper. So there was Bill Compton and Eric Northman from True Blood. There was Stefan and Damon in The Vampire Diaries, Angel and Spike in Buffy, Mitchell and Aiden in the English and American versions of Being Human, Mick St. John in Moonlight, that one season CBS show, which was wonderful, and I could go on and on. And of course, the Cullens. I was very much struck. At that moment, a light bulb went on for me. But before I tell you that, I want to digress for a minute. I was very struck by a line in Nina Auerbach's book, Are Vampires Ourselves, which came out about more than 15 years ago. She wrote, "Every society creates the vampire it needs." So I started thinking about what we truly need right now. I began to see that vampires have always reflected the fears and concerns of an age. Take Bram Stoker's Dracula, for example. It was written at the end of the 19th century, at a time when England had some of the largest ports in the world, says the historian Benita Blessing, who teaches modern European history at Ohio University. Here you have a ship arriving from Eastern Europe bearing soil from another country, a plague-like person who was going to bring death and destruction. What were the concerns at this time? Foreign illnesses, unwanted immigrants. What Dracula is really about is the fear of what we might call globalization. Dracula was the perfect image to reflect those fears. An Eastern European monster, dark, mysterious, alien. You can do this for many periods of history. The first vampire short story in the English language, Vampire, by John William Polidori, was published in 1819, but it was begun in 1816, a few years before, on that same weekend, in the same chateau in Switzerland where Mary Shelley began her work on Frankenstein. It was a time when the scientific revolution was bringing up fears of science replacing God. To give one more example, in the 1980s, just as the AIDS epidemic was spreading, there were a slew of vampire novels that saw vampirism as an infection, a disease. It's almost this perfect vessel, says Eric Newsom, the author of a very fun survey, The Dead Travel Fast, Stalking Vampires from Nosferatu to Count Chocula. If you want to understand any moment in time or any cultural moment, just look at their vampires. Now, none of this is that surprising, but why are vampires attracted to us now? What are the fears and concerns they speak to? What kind of vampires are we creating? How different are they from what went before? So I looked again at my list of popular vampires over the last 20 years, Angel and Spike, the Cullens, Eric and Bill, Stefan and Damon, Mitchell and Aiden, on and on, and the light bulb that went off was this. They're all guilt-ridden and conflicted. Unlike many of the vampires of old, they are struggling desperately to be moral, despite their history as predators and their need for blood. Sometimes they succeed, more often they fail, but they are always conflicted. They are what I have been calling the desperately struggling to be moral, despite being predators, vampire, the one that represents our own current struggle. Vampires are exactly us right now as we continue to wage wars, consume energy, find ourselves unable and unwilling to figure out solutions to global planetary issues. To be blunt, we are sucking the lifeblood out of the planet. Some of us think we can get around this by lowering our carbon footprint, riding bicycles, recycling, but the truth is that these solutions that are necessary are systemic, and frankly, none of these individual actions do much to change the world. We live compromised lives. Whitley Strieber, author of The Hunger, actually said to me, "Our prey is the planet." If so, vampires are us, and the issue before us is how we can learn to use our formidable powers without destroying the planet for future generations. You could argue that we've been as addicted to oil and fossil fuels as any vampire is addicted to blood. We depend on continuing a poisonous, addictive relationship to the planet. When I first thought about these desperately struggling to be moral vampires in literature and on television, I assumed it all started with the vampires I mentioned. But it probably goes back more than 40 years, to before The Vampire Chronicles by Anne Rice. One of the first truly conflicted vampires might well be Barnabas in Dark Shadows, alternately murderous and moral. Dark Shadows started in 66, but Barnabas didn't enter the story until 67, just after the time Stuart Brand was sending out those buttons about seeing the Earth from space. In fact, the word vampire was not used to describe Barnabas until 68, just around the time we see that first image from Apollo. On December 24, 1968, Apollo 8 brought us that first good picture of our white and blue, fragile Earth as seen from space. On Christmas Day, 1968, Archibald MacLeish wrote in the New York Times Magazine, "The medieval notion of the Earth put man at the center of everything. The nuclear notion of Earth put him nowhere, beyond the range of reason even, lost in absurdity and war. This latest notion may remake our image of mankind. To see the Earth as it truly is, small and blue and beautiful, in that eternal silence where it floats, is to see ourselves as riders on the Earth together, brothers on that bright loveliness in the eternal cold, brothers who now know they are truly brothers." Rusty Schweikert, one of the astronauts on the next Apollo, Apollo 9, wrote in a 1974 essay, "It's so small and so fragile and such a precious little spot in that universe that you can block it out with your thumb when you're up in space. And you realize that on that small spot, that little blue and white thing is everything that means anything to you. All of history and music and poetry and art and death and birth and love, tears, joys, games, all of it on that little spot out there that you can cover with your thumb. And you realize from that perspective that you've changed and that there's something new there and that the relationship is no longer what it was." Quite simply, these images transformed the way we saw the Earth. For many of us, it was the first real understanding of ourselves as being connected, as beings connected to the fate of the planet, who had a role in preserving it. Space seemed vast, our planet seemed small and vulnerable. What we did suddenly mattered. The shift helped fuel the environmental movement. Soon after, in April 1970, the first Earth Day took place. The photographs also showed the impact of oceans and weather and even human activities. We suddenly saw the Earth as a living system. Now, it's very easy to romanticize this idea that the image of Earth from space allowed us to see that we are now brothers and sisters, boundaries are illusions, we all have to get along. But the deeper truth about this shift in perspective is a darker vision. Many of us began to see ourselves as morally compromised beings, unable to shift our lives to mirror the changes we viscerally understood from this new perspective to be necessary. So it wasn't the optimistic view, "We are all brothers," of Archibald MacLeish. Our new sense of responsibility established a feeling of conflict and guilt. The late Carl Sagan writes in his book, Pale Blue Dot, "Our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position are challenged by this point of pale light. Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. There is no hint that help will come from elsewhere to save us from ourselves." You can see this change in perspective in the writings of Stuart Brand when he put out the first edition of the Whole Earth Catalog. He said, "We are as gods and might as well get good at it." But in the most recent book, Whole Earth Discipline, he says, "We are as gods and have to get good at it." What partly led to our identification with vampires and the creation of vampires who are in a desperate moral struggle is the fear that our actions are causing irreversible damage. So I've talked about mortality, power, identity, the fate of the planet. I've left out spirituality, and I only have a few minutes. I recently came across a book that brought this idea to the fore. It's called Gothica, Vampire Heroes, Human Gods, and the New Supernatural by Victoria Nelson, a professor at Goddard. And she says that the supernatural has now taken a new turn to the light. And she says that it's a vehicle for new religious movements. And she even believes that in our time, for those outside the pale of orthodoxy, Gothic pop culture products, such as the great old ones, vampires, Klingons, orcs, what you have you, offer the only easily accessible bridge to the transcendental. And she says that if there's a Mormon piece in Meyer's writing, it's not abstinence, or as I argued, large families, but it's the belief that if you live the right life, you'll die and become a kind of god. You know, think about all those ideas about the Mormons getting their own planet in the afterlife. Well, in a chapter called The Bright God Beckons about Edward Cullen and Twilight, she notes that Bella becomes a perfected being. She's transformed into a kind of goddess. She becomes someone totally empowered. And she says, and she quotes her, "I don't want to be Lois Lane. I want to be Superman too." Nelson gives many other examples from vampire fiction of a human protagonist whose supernatural change leads to becoming a divinity of sorts. So it's just like that old quote, "We are as gods and might as well get good at it." Somehow or another, Nelson notes, the vampire portrayed for 200 years as a ruthless, unredeemed killer has turned into the ethical, committed lover of a heroine whose fate is to find her true identity by dying and triumphantly joining him on a transformed dark side, transformed into light. The theme of so many of these books, she says, is spiritual transcendence. Think of the X-Men, think of the Matrix. At the end of Gothica, Nelson asks, why is this the spiritual quest of the moment and not some new sense of invented deities? And she doesn't have an answer, but she notes that most people don't want to worship the goddess Bella Swan or fall into Edward's arms. They want to be her or him. The notion of self-deification is somehow in the metaphysical air surrounding all these various narratives, she says. And she's optimistic that many of these beliefs, although individualistic, are anti-authoritarian and turn away from the demonic and move toward human accountability. So Catherine Ramsland says, you know, who spent enormous time, like Ricardo, talking with people, says she comes to the conclusion that vampires are like gods of ancient times, and that young people often see themselves as fragile and flickering, and therefore look toward them. They feel that they're the exact opposite of the strong, long-lived vampire. And so in a world where corporations are people and individual action often seems meaningless, in a world where young people need to, quote, rise again, a noble path, using fantasy as a psychological tool and a spiritual tool actually seems reasonably reasonable. Of course, there is the problem of self-delusion and gurus and all that, and I don't have time to talk about that. I want to say that as I continue to watch and identify with those conflicted, desperately struggling to be moral vampires, I note that my own search is now more focused on wanting an answer to the urgent questions of planetary survival. As Brand would say, we are as gods and have in capital letters to get good at it. We need to find our voice as powerful activists, but we can use every imaginative tool we have in our toolbox, even vampires. And one last thing. As I have taken this journey, many people have looked at me askance. And they've silently thought, how could an intelligent person like you spend 3 years reading such crap? Here's my answer. I use a quote found in Nelson's Gothica. She attributes it partly to the late great science fiction writer Philip K. Dick, although it's not an actual quote. When the divine has been exiled from the table of serious art and intellectual discussion for well over a century, sometimes you have to look for it in what elite culture calls the trash. Thank you.